Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The White House is trying to play down reports it knew Russia had paid the Taliban bounties to kill U.S. troops, promising to brief Democrats on Tuesday after being accused of only sharing information with President Trump's fellow Republicans. Trump administration officials said that there was no consensus on the underlying intelligence among U.S. agencies, and Mr. Trump had not been made aware of it. But two Republican lawmakers, Representatives Mac Thornberry and Liz Cheney, who attended the meeting, said they remain concerned after hearing details from the White House at a meeting on Monday. The New York Times and Washington Post broke the story, with the Post reporting on Sunday that several American soldiers were believed to have died as a result of the program, which the Kremlin has denied. John Ratcliffe, the director of national intelligence, said intelligence officials are still investigating the matter. Since hitting the milestone of 500,000 deaths from COVID-19 early Sunday morning, the global figure has now jumped by approximately 5,000 more. In the U.S., the figure has climbed to more than 126,000 dead. The number of confirmed infections globally is 10.3 million. At least 285 U.S. children have developed a serious inflammatory condition linked to the coronavirus. That's according to two studies published Monday that provide the fullest picture yet of the ailment. Worldwide, about 1,000 kids have been affected during the pandemic. The U.S. studies show most children recovered after intensive care treatment, but many had heart complications, and the potential for long-term or permanent damage is unknown. The condition is known as multisystem inflammatory syndrome. Kids in at least 35 states have been affected by it. Most had current or recent COVID-19 infections, but were previously healthy. This is VOA News. A Minnesota judge is warning that he is likely to move the trials of four former police officers charged in George Floyd's death out of Minneapolis if public officials and attorneys continue speaking out about the case. The county judge, Peter Cahill, asked a prosecutor during a pretrial hearing Monday to use his influence to get public officials to stop talking about the case. If they don't, he says, he'll have to move the trial or trials, depending on whether the officers are tried together or separately. Floyd, a black man in handcuffs, died May 25th after Officer Eric Chauvin held his knee on Floyd's neck for nearly 8 minutes. Some public officials were quick to call Floyd's death a murder. Kansas City's black mayor says that he was called a racist slur and told he should swing from a tree after he announced mandatory face masks in the Missouri city. And Mayor Quentin Lucas on Monday shared a screenshot of the text on Twitter. The exchange comes after Lucas said masks are mandatory in Kansas City when 6 feet of separation is not feasible. It's unclear if police are investigating the text to the mayor as a threat. An Associated Press request for comment to a Kansas City police spokesman was not immediately returned. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam said that it was not appropriate for her to comment on national security legislation for the city, as a meeting in Beijing to discuss the law is still ongoing. Lam was speaking at a weekly news conference shortly after local media reported that China's parliament had passed a contentious national security law for the city. Lam acknowledged there had been widespread public speculation and concern regarding the legislation, and she would comment once details were unveiled. Former police officer who terrorized California as a serial burglar and rapist and killed more than a dozen people has pleaded guilty to the murders attributed to the Golden State Killer. Joseph James DeAngelo Jr. had remained almost silent in court since his 2018 arrest until he repeatedly uttered the word guilty Monday. He pleaded guilty to 13 murders and admitted to dozens of rapes. The plea agreement spares him the death penalty for a life sentence with no chance of parole. Prosecutors say he muttered to himself after being arrested about an inner personality that had forced him to commit those crimes. Google says it has removed misleading ads targeting Americans looking for information about how to vote in November's presidential election. Some of the ads charged fees for registering people to vote, while others sucked up people's personal information for marketing purposes. The ads were discovered by the nonprofit tech watchdog Tech Transparency Project. The group found that search terms such as register to vote and vote by mail and where's my polling place generated ads to linking those websites. via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Some Malawians are welcoming their new president's partial cabinet announcement.
Overall, it's a cabinet that is inspiring, and it's a cabinet that I think many Malawians are really looking forward to in as far as delivering the promises that the two candidates had actually promised during the campaign.
Zambia's opposition leader calls for electoral reform ahead of the 2021 election. Kenya's tourism loses 80 billion Kenya shillings due to coronavirus emergency. Eswatini teachers say they are not ready to reopen schools on July 6. Gabon Senate decriminalizes homosexuality, and a judge has again granted bail to Lesotho's former first lady.
In my humble opinion, this is going to be a very warm message. Because now, crimes of murder are very prevalent in the country. And if the court can be seen to be so lenient, I think it's not going to have any deterrent effect to the potential criminals.
Paseka Mukite is the Deputy Police Commissioner of the Kingdom of Lesotho, and there's a drop in health workers' attendance in Sierra Leone due to the coronavirus. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawian activist is hailing the partial cabinet announced Monday by newly elected President Lazarus Chakwera as a sign that the new government means business when it comes to fighting corruption. The president picked his vice president, Solos Chelema, as Minister for Economic Planning and Development and Public Sector Reforms. President Chakwera also chose two veteran lawyers, Chikosa Silongwe as Attorney General and Monica Msiska as Justice Minister. Makumbo Mutale is the Malawi Governor's Commentator.
I think the overall impression that we're getting with this partial cabinet is that the current regime seems to be determined in as far as fighting corruption as well as also holding to account those that were involved in the corrupt practices in the previous regime. This has been a call that many Malawians have been actually looking forward to. Overall, it's a cabinet that is inspiring, and it's a cabinet that I think many Malawians are really looking forward to in as far as delivering the promises that the two candidates had actually promised them during the campaign.
What can you tell us about Solos Chelema? Is he likely to play both roles as vice president and as Minister for Economic Planning and Development?
I think Solos Chelema's appointment, it's not surprising. Mindful of the fact that I think the Chakwera had indicated in one of the interviews that he wants to utilize Chelema against the background that he's such a person that was underutilized under the previous regime. So definitely what the current president is trying to do is to make the office of the vice president relevant in terms of having specific duties which can be able to be accounted for.
What does the choice of Chikosa Silongwe as justice or attorney general, what does this appointment signify in terms of the president's declaration to fight corruption?
The choice of Mordecai Msisha as a senior counsel, as well as Dr. Chikosa Silongwe as Minister of Justice and Attorney General, has been welcomed widely by a number of stakeholders. This is because these are respected lawyers who have got a very strong track record, actually in practice as well as in ethics in Malawi. And looking at one of the cornerstones that the current regime is actually promoting, accountability and rule of law, many Malawians have confidence that these are the right people that can drive the crusade against corruption.
Should we expect women will play a role in the Chakwera cabinet?
I think one of the concerns that the public had is that it only had one one female who is basically the deputy chief secretary. And I think this addressed some questions around whether the current regime is really committed to the commitments that the government of Malawi has made under the CEDAW and other international covenant. That is also besides the already law in Malawi, the Gender Equality Act, which provides 60 to 40% ratio of either sex in a public appointment. But then I think the president has defended himself today during the swearing in of the cabinet ministers that in his less than 30-member cabinet, which is going to finalize in the next few days, he's going to ensure that there is at least 40% of women representation in the next cabinet.
Makumbo Mutale is the Malawi governance commentator. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. The leader of Zambia's opposition All People's Congress Party is calling for electoral reforms ahead of next year's general election. Nelson Msawani says his party will seek reforms of the Electoral Commission as part of the group's effort to ensure that the elections are transparent and credible. He also wants a change in the leadership of the Zambian Electoral Commission. Civil society and opposition groups often accuse the commission of bias towards the ruling Patriotic Front Party. Supporters of the ruling party have rejected the accusation as without merit. Nelson Msawani tells viewers Peter Clotty that if the electoral reforms are not properly addressed, Zambia could plunge into chaos.
Yes, we think that for us to have a credible election that satisfies all other stakeholders, there have got to be reforms, and these reforms should start with the commission itself. We think that this commission is currently skewed in favor of the ruling party. We think that this commission has a predetermined position. Looking at the behavior of the commission, that the commission is not making consultations, broader consultations, with other political stakeholders. So we think that this commission is already hired to produce a result that is in favor of the current ruling party.
But Mr. Msomni, the issue is that the Zambia Electoral Commission, or the Electoral Commission of Zambia, is independent. So when it rolled out recently its roadmap for the election, that gives all the political parties enough time to prepare for next year's election. So where is the bias here, they argue?
Well, like I've said, it's obvious that we are headed for another sham election. And I think that the party in government is already preparing for a petition in advance, meaning that the election will not be free and fair. We think that the current composition suits the current the current position of the ruling party. So we think that for us to have a free and fair election, we need first to have reform with the so-called independent commission. We all know that the current election commission is not independent.
So let me ask you this. What specific reforms does your party want to see in order to accept that next year's election will be free and credible?
Yes, first, we think that the current composition of commissioners that sit in the so-called independent commission, I think we need changes there. If we are going to have an election result which will be accepted by all other political players, I think we need to reconstruct the commission so that genuinely it reflects an inclusive character. Currently, it's biased in favor of the ruling party. So we think that reforms are the necessary starting point for us to have a credible election.
But Mr. Somni, there have been instances where the Electoral Commission has engaged all political parties and other stakeholders. And officials of the Electoral Commission are telling me that they will continue to do so in order to ensure a fair process and a transparent process. Why are you not satisfied with this?
Well, I think the consultations are merely for the sake of this, because some of the decisions that ultimately come are those that reflect the interests of the party in power. So we don't think that this commission is in a position to create or to offer all to hold an election that will be free and fair in its current form.
Nassim Sani is the leader of Zambia's opposition All People's Congress Party. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. Kenya's tourism sector has lost $752 million in revenue since the outbreak of COVID-19 3 months ago. Speaking Monday in Nairobi, Tourism Cabinet Secretary Najib Balala said the industry can only manage to recover 30% of the loss during the 2020-2021 financial year once the country reopens its economy. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, hotels and travel agencies have sent their employees on unpaid leave as most of them struggle to sustain themselves.
Tourism is among the main sectors contributing to economic growth of Kenya, with at least 21% and closure of the airspace. Cessation of inter-county movement as a way of containing the spread of COVID-19 immensely contributed to revenue loss. Tourism Cabinet Secretary Najib Balala said that with the cases of the virus now above 6,000 mark and counting, the sector has already lost 50% of its revenues.
We lost almost 80 billion Kenya shillings. So that is almost 0.8 million. So we lost 50% of our revenue of 1.6 billion. So the first half we got it. The second half is literally as good as zero. So we have a major problem. We lost 50% of our revenue.
In 2018-2019 financial year, the sector received more than 2 million tourist arrivals, bringing in tourism revenue of Kenya shillings 164 billion. Balala says at the moment, the sector will depend on domestic tourism as the international tourism is projected to remain affected until mid-2021.
For 2020-2021, which is starting from 1st of July, we're only going to get back less than 30%. From the 6th of July, because the country will open up, definitely we know there'll be some international tourism coming in December because of the holidays, but proper international recovery will be in summer 2021. So that is our projection so far.
Thousands of employees in the sector have been laid off as most companies closed down due to economic difficulties. However, Mr. Balala says those rendered redundant at workplace once the economy reopens will be given priority.
People employed in the tourism sector are above 2 million, but you know now we have a lockdown, so the entire tourism sector is out of business at the moment, so there are major job losses. But we have been assured immediately we start opening, even the people who have been sent home on redundancy, the minute the economy starts picks up, they'll be the first people who will be given the priority to come back because they're already skilled and trained.
The tourism industry in Kenya contributes greatly to national development through employment creation, environmental conservation and management, income generation, source of foreign exchange, among other benefits, with all these subsectors having been negatively affected. On July 6th, President Uhuru Kenyatta is expected to address the nation on the review of the containment measures that have so far been given, including the cessation of movement in and out of Nairobi, Mombasa and Mandera counties, as well as the dusk to dawn curfew. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 30th. Teachers in Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, say they and their schools are now ready to reopen on July 6th as ordered by the government. The government wants students in grades 7, 9, and 12 to return to school next week to write their external exams. The government has ordered that the schools be prepared to comply with COVID-19 guidelines, including the provision of sanitizers, soap, and running water, social distancing, and the wearing of masks. But Dlamini Bongwa, president of the Swaziland National Association of Teachers, says most of their schools are rural schools and that it is not possible to get them ready before July 6th. He also says the government must make available the necessary funding.
As teachers, we are very much ready to return to school, but unfortunately, the situation doesn't allow us to do so. The necessary measures which are supposed to be looked after by the government, things that we expect as per the expectation of the WHO, things like running water, things like masks, sanitizer, and a lot of things, The government hasn't done anything. In fact, the schools are like the day we left them when the COVID-19 started.
As you said, the teachers are professionals. As in every profession, the doctors, whenever they are called, they perform their duties. So if you are not ready to go to school, are you not concerned about the education of the children of Eswatini?
We are very much concerned, James, about our students. In fact, we have been trying so hard to assist even the government in preparing the school so that we can be able to teach. But what is happening right now, the government is not concerned about the lives of the teachers that are going to teach the students, because what is most important is that we have to teach while we are also looking after our lives, because it is very important that we don't risk the lives of the teachers, because we don't have having teachers going there just 1 month and we find that a large number of them have been affected by the virus. So now what we have done, we are saying to the government, how can we assist? Let us go together. But now government simply holds meetings every now and then, but there is nothing that is happening on the ground to prepare the schools.
You also said that some of your teachers, they have pre-existing conditions. So how did you know that?
In fact, it is an obvious situation. In our country, the health status of most citizens, not only teachers. So most Swazis here are suffering from diabetes. They are suffering from chronic asthma. They are suffering from a lot of those diseases, which we understand they can cause harm if a situation whereby one can contact the virus.
Where can you and the government meet? I mean, is there a middle ground?
Yes, there is. In fact, what we can do, because it is not all the classes that are supposed to start learning at the moment, so those with maybe underlying conditions, they may be excused for a while, without conditions, maybe to go start, and maybe some other things are being taken care of. Except for those, James, we have got other comrades here, like some are on wheelchair, and then talking about social distancing, imagine someone who is supposed to be pushed on a wheelchair. How can they obey their social distancing?
Dlamini Mbongwa is the president of the Swaziland National Association of Teachers. A court in Lesotho has granted bail to former First Lady Masaya Thabane. The police accuse her of murdering the former Prime Minister's estranged wife, Lepolelo. The former Prime Minister, Dr. Thomas Thabane, is also accused of playing a role in the murder, an accusation he has denied. The former First Lady also denies ordering the killing of the estranged wife of the former Prime Minister. Deputy Police Commissioner Pasik Munketi tells VOS Peter Clotty that it appears the court did not take into consideration the possibility that Mrs. Thabane may try to escape justice.
Well, I haven't read the judgment yet, but I received a report that the former First Lady has been granted bail with some conditions, which I haven't studied them because I haven't received the judgment, as I just said. I'll make an opinion having studied the judgment and whether I agree with the judge or not. So I think it's too early now to express my opinion as to whether the bail has been granted following the right procedure, or some reasons are very valid that she ought to have been given a bail or not. Anyway, having obtained the judgment, I'll be in a position to make a decision as to whether I will appeal the judgment, or I will just be convinced that, well, there are some reasons that actually the judge was convinced that the former president was entitled to be granted bail.
Now, let me ask you this, DCP. I understand some of his critics are saying if this is carried out, she has run away before and she could run away again. Is that what you think could happen?
Well, that has been our argument before the court, but it looks like the court did not take into that consideration when granted the bail. Actually, as I said, I think having received the judgment, I'll understand how the court reacted to that submission, to our submission. But the fact that when we called the former First Lady to the police station for questioning, she fled the country. And she came back under very, very after having been persuaded to come back. And now the court has just overlooked that and did not even put any weight to our submission. Well, I think at this stage, frankly speaking, I am not in the position to actually tell us to what actually persuaded the court to grant a bail. And so, what are the factors that the court is taking into consideration when they assess all the evidence that has been placed before we? And they came up with the decision that this was entitled to bail.
Now, DCP, if I may ask you, why does the police, or why will the police describe the former first lady as very dangerous?
Well, the nature of the crime that has been committed actually says it all, that the manner in which it was planned, executed, and the persons who are involved in the commission of the crime, actually, obvious that she's associated herself with very dangerous people, and as far as human beings, treated as such as well.
Paseka Mukete is the Deputy Police Commissioner of the Kingdom of Lesotho. Gabon Senate voted unanimously on Monday to decriminalize homosexuality, a 2019 law made Gabon one of 12 African countries that have made sex between men and sex between women a crime. Reuters news agency reports that President Ali Bongo's wife, Sylvia, had expressed her support for the bill. Frank Jokting is a Gabonese human rights activist. He says while he is not against homosexuality, the Gabonese parliament needed to focus more on issues most important to the Gabonese people, including good governance and development.
I am very shocked at what the Gabonese Senate did for the simple fact that they haven't taken in consideration what the majority of the Gabonese people want. I have nothing against homosexuality. I think people have the right to do whatever they want to do. But I believe that when we live in a country and when we live as people, it is important that the interests of the many should be protected. And of course, the homosexual in Gabon were never discriminated before. I never heard somebody going to jail or somebody being persecuted because of homosexuality. So I don't understand why is the urgency right now. I think the urgency in Gabon is the rule of law, is good governance, is the ability of the Gabonese people to be able to vote and their vote be respected, to be able to choose their elected official. That's what we need to focus about. I don't think that who the Gabonese people are sleeping with or doing in their sexual activity is important. We have so many problems. We don't have running waters. The poverty level is very high in a country that is very rich. And I think that this government need to focus on that instead of bringing problems that will polarize us and divide us more than unite us.
So what do you think might have motivated the Senate and Gabon's government particularly to decriminalize homosexuality? Because I read somewhere where they thought that the First Lady of Gabon might have also had a role in pushing this.
I personally believe that most of the problem of most of African countries is because we have failed governments, because we have a government who are not sensitive to the will of the people, and because they are not working for the people. They're always begging for money. And unfortunately, when they go to those people who can lend them money, the people are lending them money with conditions. So I believe that wherever Gabon government went to get some money, they were told that we are willing to give you money, but we want you to depenalize homosexuality in Gabon. And I think that's why they did that. So again, what is appalling in this is that they have chosen to humiliate Gabonese people in order to be in agreement with foreign entities in order for them to have the money that they're looking for.
Frank Jokting is a Gabonese human rights activist. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. And that's it for this Tuesday, June 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to ndumbulu and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.